Was this Halloween or?
God, no. That's the most embarrassing thing of all of this. What kind of fool gets her heart broken by a bloody stage magician?
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
Anyway, R-Max, Goodwin, you are here in our black box today.
Yes.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Doing well. How are you doing, Nick?
Good. Good. Thank you for coming and battling LA traffic.
Sure.
Don't mind me. I'm just going to be playing with this with
okay,
levels.
No worries.
But we're going. And, you know, when I first met you, one of the things that stood out the most was your name.
Yeah.
And I think that's such a great marketing tool because people probably have to ask you about it
sure.
three times.
Yep.
But they're never going to forget R-Max.
It, you know, it's true. I mean, it never was meant to be like a stage name or let's come up with something clever. That was never the intention, which a lot of people think. And then other people think, like, R-Max, where are you from? You know, they think that has to do with my origin or something like that. But I was named Robert Maxwell Goodwin, and then nobody called me Robert. I was just Max. And then in preschool, there were a couple Maxes. So to try to differentiate us, they took the R from Robert and put it at the front of Max. So I've been R-Max since I was like 2 years old.
You didn't have a choice in the matter.
I didn't have a choice in the matter, exactly. And then it just sort of stuck, and it's like, why not? Mm-hmm. And now it's been rather convenient because, like you say, a lot of people remember it. It's unique and so forth. So,
mm-hmm.
And then it's funny, a couple times when I've worked at the castle, they've just shortened my name to R-Max. So instead of R-Max Goodwin, they just have called me R-Max, which I think
it's a very Madonna quality.
Yeah, I think it's a little presumptuous at this point, but it's flattering, I guess. But yeah, it's true. When I'm strolling, it's like, you know, every group that I come to, it's R-Max, where are you from? Or so forth.
He's an immigrant.
Yeah.
Kick
yeah,
him
right,
out.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So you started in the castle in the junior program, is that
yep.
correct?
Yeah.
Give us like a 1 or 2 minute bio about your magic history.
Sure, yeah. So I started doing magic when I was a little kid, about 7 years old. And then, and my dad just sort of taught me a couple tricks, kind of kept going from there. The magic, the Hollywood Magic was a wonderful store in Hollywood for a number of years, huge store. And some of the guys who worked there kind of helped me out, showed me the ropes, mentored me a bit. And then when I was 14, I auditioned for the Magic Castle Junior program, which is a program where you meet once a month and you workshop your act. You do your set, everybody critiques you, and you kind of go from there. And they also offer you the ability to audition to perform at the brunches, which
okay.
is a really nice you know, area to perform. And if you do that, you're doing like 5 shows a day
wow.
on Saturday or Sunday. And that's fantastic because, you know, it's hard to get that sort of flight time
mm-hmm.
anywhere else, you know, in the world. And then once a year they have their annual, what's it called? Future Stars of Magic Week, where they invite some of the people who've been performing at the brunches and in some other venues to work there for a week, just like quote-unquote adult performer.
Okay.
And that's great because then you're also performing in a more formal environment of, you know, the nighttime at the castle.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's great. It's a really great place where you learn to take criticism because you have a lot of people who are better than you,
mm-hmm.
right? If you come in at 14, you're going to have people who are 20 years old who've been doing it for, you know, 5 years. And then you have professionals who come in occasionally and just take apart your whole act, you
yeah.
know. And
how old were you when like professionals started like ripping you apart?
I would say 15.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's very early to like
yeah. I mean, not too many, mm-hmm. you know, and they'll go nameless, but you know, I had a couple people who definitely said like, "Hey, let's chat," you know, and
did you
here's
feel
everything
that to
wrong
be,
with your show.
Did you feel that to be beneficial or was that frustrating?
Because
I know as like a teenager for me, the last thing I want to hear is you're terrible, this
right.
is terrible, fix it.
Well, actually the first time that I did just the workshop at the junior program, I had a bunch of kids critiquing me and then I also had a few of the adults who run the program critiquing me. And that whole session was, I mean, terrible in a way that they just all destroyed my set, you know,
mm-hmm.
But it was also good because you learn to take criticism very early, and
yeah.
I responded to it, I think, in a good way. Obviously, some people could recoil and just be like, "Oh my gosh, you know, I can't take this or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it was good for me because, you know, when you're taking criticism for so many people, some people don't know what they're talking about, you know?
Sure.
And so you learn to kind of push those comments away and listen and heed the comments that are spot on and so forth. So that's good. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, because, you know, criticism is necessary and important, and, you know, every chance I get, people I respect, mm-hmm. I want them to critique
sure.
a show I've done or something like that. But it's when it's unwarranted, when somebody comes up after a show and says, hey, so-and-so, this, I immediately shut down because I just like, I don't want to hear it.
And I've had it from a number of different people. I mean, like, when I started doing it performing at the Castle when I was like 15 or 16, I had people who've never performed at the Castle but have been members for 30 years.
Oh, sure.
You know, give me comments. And not to say that they're, you know, there's some wonderful people who don't perform at the Castle who've been members for a long time who are fantastic performers. But give me all sorts of comments where I didn't really ask for it and mm-hmm. whatever. And then I've had also people who are not performers but are maybe they work in some other medium, right?
Okay.
Give me criticism where, you know, that's interesting but is not relevant for
sure.
live performance, you know?
Sure.
So, yeah, it's been a good lesson, though, and I think I'll, you know, take that in other areas of my life as well, kind of apply it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm like, I don't mean, I hope I don't sound snooty about it, but it's, you need criticism, and it only makes
totally.
You better. But if it's coming from the
sure.
wrong voice, I think it can hurt you.
Sure, sure. And sometimes it's clear that the criticism is not even really meant to make you better. You
sure.
know,
and it's probably coming out of a lot of criticism I see, or at least in the quote-unquote politics of magic.
Yeah.
It's coming from a place of fear and a place
sure.
of, you know, not feeling as good. So you have to, you know, put
totally.
Your opinion out there.
Completely.
And that's a dangerous thing.
It's dangerous. But it is one of the great things that the Castle offers, that you're performing so often. You are performing for magicians,
sure.
which is really a weird thing to be doing in the context of the greater magic world, you know. But you do have the opportunity to get incredible feedback from wonderful, you know, magicians. And that's fantastic. And I think magic is something that – or the performances of magic is an area where so many performers don't take criticism. You know,
sure.
they don't – you know, I know that comedians, for example, the moment they finish their set, they're – listening to the tape, they're looking at, you know, the timing, they're analyzing everything that they did wrong, whereas I think oftentimes with magicians, you know, they finish the show, they have people come up to them, say that was fantastic, because a lot of people just have never seen magic before,
yeah.
and of course it's fantastic to them, and they just think they're great, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they don't really ever look back at what they're doing
sure.
and self-criticize or have other informed people criticize them, you know,
mm-hmm.
so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's an important distinction, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This subject has come up, I think, in the past couple episodes, which is weird,
oh, yeah.
but just like the idea of somebody saying your magic show is maybe the only live magic show they'll
right.
ever see in their entire life,
totally,
with the exception of maybe one or two other people, and it's
right.
not like that in any other art form.
Definitely, and so many people have a probably rightfully bad opinion of magic,
mm-hmm.
you know, that if you're halfway decent, you're probably amazing to them, you
sure.
know, and so many people also just think of magic as children performers, you
yeah.
know, and so they see somebody do something that's slightly more serious or you know, appeals to an older crowd, and, you know, they think it's great, even
sure.
if it's
mm-hmm.
pretty simple.
Yeah, yeah. What are your – because you do a lot of corporate events,
mm-hmm.
and what are your aspirations? What's something you want to – a goal down the line?
Yeah, well, I would love to, from a performance perspective, not so much career perspective, but from a performance perspective, be able to just perform in any environment, which is something that currently I'm not able to do. So in a close-up environment, basically any close-up environment, I feel pretty confident, but I would definitely like that to be stronger, and I would like to be able to have like an hour and a half long show that is, you know, an actual show, not just like, let's see here. Here's another cool thing that I know, you know?
Sure.
So I would like to have that under my belt that I could whip out sort of whenever I need to. And same thing on stage. So stage magic is something that I'm slowly building as far as my repertoire that is. And it's something that I would like to be able to have like an hour and a half show that I could perform, you know, for 60 people, for 100 people, for 5,000 people, you know, and be able to do it in any venue, whether people are in a theater or if they are in a banquet hall sitting around tables, you know. So that's what I would like to be able to do. I think I would feel very confident and accomplished at that.
So you come from a close-up perspective first?
Yes.
You feel more confident in your close-up ability?
Yes. That's where I have the most experience, and I've been focusing on my,
What type of close-up venues have you worked besides the castle?
Yeah, so besides the close-up gallery at the castle, I do a lot of strolling magic, and a lot of like the private social events that I've done have been private or close-up shows, and that has been anything from like small banquet halls in a hotel to homes and private residences, things like that. Yeah.
So how do you? For me, it kind of, if I'm doing a show, I see it all in the same vein. Even if the space is different, how do you differentiate a show and versus a close up show or a parlor show?
I guess I think of,
because I feel like from what I've seen of yours, your show could translate fine into a stage show.
Right. I guess I really like close up magic because there's this break in the fourth wall, right, between the audience and the performer, and it tends to have a more casual feel to it. And I know that, even if it's, you know, very high quality, it has a slightly less theatrical feel to it. And I really enjoy that. I enjoy that bantering. I enjoy that those moments that are different from the previous show. And obviously you have that in stage. You know, you have the times, and especially, I guess, with a very experienced stage performer, they can have a more casual attitude where they're, you know, they kind of digress at times and so forth. Like the last time I saw Michael Finney, it was really pretty amazing. I mean, he went into these long stories that you're like, dude, you're in the middle of a show, you know? But it was great. I mean, he killed it. It was just an incredible show. And he was able to do that just because he had so much experience.
Sure.
And knew how to control an audience and keep them at bay and also excite them and so forth. And so I guess for me, since I am more confident with the close-up, I feel like I can take those moments to kind of go off course occasionally, engage people that, you know, maybe I shouldn't have engaged in, or if I shouldn't engage on a stage show, you know. And in stage, when I perform stage magic, I'm less confident in digressing or just sort of changing the pace of the show. So I have a much more structured act when I perform stage magic.
That's true. Yeah, you can freestyle and you can jazz when you're doing close up. You know, something goes wrong or somebody says something or does something, you can react to it. And stage show's a little bit harder.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that the pacing with a stage show has to be much more controlled, much
it has
structured.
To feel like a performance.
Yeah.
It has to feel beginning, middle, and end. You know?
Unless you're more in the camp of a comedian, you know, then you can kind of change things up, I think. But I'm really not there. So
I really enjoyed. I saw Willman a couple of weeks ago at the castle, and he had he's a comedian who does magic, and I told him this to his face. But he has such nice storytelling and so many nice monologues that lead into each trick and explain, okay, this is why we're going into this.
Sure.
It really felt like an all-encompassing show, and I felt like not enough of that is done in a stage show. So what you're talking about is very true.
And that's something that I guess when I differentiate stage and close-up, I guess it's an artificial distinction, you know? It's just that when I see stage magic, you so rarely see what you're talking about with Willman, where they're so comfortable, they're so in control of their material, both magic and patter-wise and their audience, that they typically aren't able to have that, you know, fluidity Yeah. You know? So mm-hmm. I would like to be in that position, which I sort of see myself in with close up. But right now it's just, you know, it's not developed mm-hmm. to that point at all.
And it's funnier yeah. to me because close up is, you know, so much more exhausting, so much more time consuming, sure. so much more skill based than a stage show.
In ways, yeah. Yeah.
You can train most people to do a stage show. That's okay.
Right.
And they'll look like a good magician, but you can't train people to do good close up magic
oftentimes,
in a short amount of time.
Especially if they're doing some heavy sleight of hand work, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. And yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. What are your influences outside of magic, acting, outside music?
Yeah, I guess yeah, some theater certainly. I try to go to see theater when I can. As well as some art, but I don't really bring art into the magic. But it's always been something that I've been interested in, and you know, regularly going to galleries and museums and things like that. And then philosophy. I studied philosophy in school, and it's probably what I read most. And I think that always informs sort of how I look at magic as well. I try not to bring philosophical concepts into magic because when I do, it ends up just really dry and sounds pretentious and isn't actually that good. But it's something that is sort of always on my mind when I'm working on magic as well. So I think it probably influences it on a, you know, sort of subconscious level for me. Yeah. Those are sort of
why philosophy? Because, I mean, Steve Martin studied that. A lot of comedians study. A lot of performers study that.
Well, I think it's related to magic in that philosophy, at least what I'm interested in philosophy, is the human experience, you know, and which is something that philosophers have been talking about for thousands of years. And magic is very – which has also obviously existed for thousands of years – is – predicated on the human experience and what it is to, you know, see things and experience things with other people. And so in the same way that magic is sort of applied psychology without ever really maybe knowing how it worked, mm-hmm. Magic is also playing with how people experience the world. And So I guess in those senses they're connected, and it's just something that's always been interesting to me. I never really thought about combining them necessarily, and I don't think I've seen it combined well. You know, whenever every now and then a magician will try to talk about science or, you know, neuroscience or something like that and demonstrate something, I think it tends to not really live up to expectations because the science or the philosophy or the morals or whatever it is that they're preaching just are so much greater than the ambitious card routine they're playing.
Yeah, that's true.
It tends to fall flat. But, you know, magic is just so much of looking at how people experience the world and sort of exploiting those moments where they don't see something, you know. And I think philosophy is also sort of looking at how people, at least again, the sort of philosophy that I'm interested in, is looking at how people, what assumptions people make and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
What were you going to say though? I cut you off.
Oh, no, it's weird how, you know, people, and I do this with a routine and I've been working on it for like a year and I'm not in love with it, but the idea of layering in. You were talking about neuroscience or bringing in something along that line as the topic to be the subject of like the card trick, the ambitious card. And it's weird how people can bring that in, layer that in, and then say, oh, I'm going to do this and this is why it works, when you're just layering on a lie on top of a lie.
Right, right.
And
you see that with mentalism all the time.
Yeah, right? Yeah, big time.
Neuro-linguistic programming, it's like, oh, I'm going to be observing your facial reactions as I say these words and so forth.
Yeah, and I do a routine like that, and I don't – morally, I feel wrong about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I tell the people –
feel like you're lying, yeah.
Yeah, and I am. You know, I tell them I'm going to figure out how they're lying by using their body language or how they say something. And that's not how the trick is done at all. And I don't – and I'm it's a struggle because, you know, it works. Audiences love it. It's a great routine. But it's – I feel – you know, I feel like I'm, like I said, layering two lies on top of each other.
Sure, sure.
Because I'm already saying at the top of the show, I'm going to lie to you, and now right. I'm lying. I don't know, maybe that negates the lie? Yeah. I'm not sure.
I guess when I've done it, and I tend to make fun of it a little bit. So I'll talk about how, like, I am using my my skills in observation and perception to determine what you're thinking. And so, for example, and I have – at this point, I have four people up on stage, and I address the person to next to me, and I say, now, for example, I can just tell based on the way you're standing and your shoulder orientation, the way your feet are positioned, that you are most likely a man, right? And this, you know, gets a laugh because it's ridiculous, obviously, right? It doesn't need an explanation. And so, like, everybody knows that, obviously, like, nonverbal communication is totally a thing, and it's completely real, you know, and there are people who are probably very trained in it. And we all obviously can look at somebody and know immediately if they're sad or so forth. And yet people take it to a level that's just also silly, you know. It's like, I can tell by the way you're smiling that, you know, you're thinking of the country Peru, you know, and they know that that's ridiculous.
Oh my God, how did they get that?
So I enjoy sort of bringing them down that path of like, oh, okay, sure, he's gonna use his skills in observation and perception. Yeah, I'm pretty observant. Let's see how he does it, you know. And then sort of just immediately saying like, no, come
then
on,
slapping them in the face and going, that's not
we're not doing that here. Yeah, you know, I know that you're not, you know, silly enough or stupid enough to think that I'm, you know, actually going to be able to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know. Yeah. If you're a mentalist, this is something you deal with on a day-to-day basis. And you either ignore the moral implications or you just go, yeah, that's how I'm going
to
do it.
And I have had people come up to me after the show, only a couple, thankfully, who have said, so like, when did you realize that you had these abilities?
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
And each time, although it's only happened a couple times, I've been just flabbergasted. You know, it's like I have no idea how to respond to somebody like this, because I think it's obvious that this is an act, you know. And I think it's also obvious that if I had any of these abilities, I would not be doing, you know, this show. I would be doing something else.
I'd be
Vegas, I'd be in Vegas or just, you know, I would have predicted the lottery and just would be, you know, sitting on the beach. Why would I do this? So, and those are moments. And I had one recently where the way that the guy asked me, you know, how long I've had these skills and how did I become aware of these skills in reference to some sort of mentalism, he was so confident that I had these skills that he wasn't even asking me, you know, is this real? He knew that it was real, and he just wanted to know how I found out and when I found out and so forth, that I wasn't even able to say, like, whoa, take a step back here, man. This is all BS. You know, I can't do any of this. That I just felt like that would have crushed him, you know? So I just sort of said, like, you know, I don't know. Known for a long time. Thanks, man. Bye. You know, try to get out of there as quickly as possible.
There's that experiment The Amazing Randy did. Did you see the documentary An Honest Liar?
Yeah.
About the if you don't know about it, it's about they did like a
was it
the CIA one? I don't know. He had a bunch of people that claimed to be psychic.
Yeah.
They went and did, you know, a serious study of them.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's different.
It went on for, I think, a couple months at least. And then the end, they all the people that claimed to have psychic powers said, no, this is all BS. And it really – you could see – they all talked about it in the interviews. They really hurt the scientists' feelings and the people who thought they were real.
This,
you know,
was with the – it was either CIA or FBI. It was some government organization where they
– I got to rewatch it.
Well, I mean, there's so much literature out there about it. The CIA – well, right, there was that book that a magician wrote for the – I think it was the CIA talking about or explaining how CIA agents could administer sort of truth serums and various drugs to like communists in the Cold War surreptitiously using sleight of hand. And this was a manual that he wrote for them. And in that whole project, they were working on very seriously with psychic phenomena and trying to figure out how to do it. And if it was real, and they totally respected it, which is terrifying. you know, yeah.
Yeah. I got to read, I'm a big John Ronson. I always confuse it with Ron Johnson or John Ronson. John Ronson. The Men Who Stare at Goats is kind of his original one. And that touches on that as well.
Yeah.
His latest book I'm just in love with, it's called So You've Been Publicly Shamed.
Oh,
and
nice.
It's just talking about this mob, digital mob mentality that's going on of somebody screws up and the internet gets wind of it and just destroys their life. You know?
And from that place of distance, these people have no qualms about just ripping into somebody in a way that they never would in person.
It's the lynch mob mentality that's going on. But it's either way, it plays into kind of all this that we're talking about.
It is also amazing, and I think one thing that was great about The Honest Liar was it also addressed how futile some of this the truth is. You know how you say like this is how it's done. He's a con man, and people still don't. It doesn't matter. They still believe it. The guy still ends up having a successful career, you know. And the truth just doesn't matter in some ways. And I have had that with people where a few years ago, I guess, people would ask me like, "Oh, so Chris Angel, like, is he legit? Like, does he really have these powers?" And I was like, "No, of course not. You know, it's ridiculous."
I always say, yeah, the green screen's real.
Yeah, right.
And people just look at me like, what?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll tell them, no, it's, you know, not real at all, you know? And it doesn't really matter. They still believe it, you know? And it's like... Yeah.
I've stopped, you know, I do that thing at the top of my talking show talking about how this is all fake, but it's okay, you know, it's an honest liar, blah, blah, blah. And I used to have a thing about psychics, you know?
Okay.
You know, I was saying before I would do like the magazine test, I would say that something about anybody who claims to have real psychic power should be locked away or something like that.
Right.
And I would always feel the audience get uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So I'd just cut it, you know, just like, all right, whatever. I'm not even going to mention it anymore because people want to believe what they want to believe.
Yeah. Some people. Right. Exactly. And here we are coming from if we know anything, this is something that we are, you know, sort of authorities on, and no, they're going to believe their own thing. You know?
I was killing time in my hotel room over the weekend before I had to go to the airport, and this new show, Hollywood Medium.
Oh, yeah. I've seen the commercials. I haven't seen the actual show.
It's pretty, like, it's so nonchalant about, oh, yeah, I'm just going to do a reading, going over to this celebrity house. I never know who I'm going to, you know, because that would be a conflict of interest. I'm like, how can you not know whose house you're going to?
Right, exactly.
And it's just, on paper, if you just look at it from a pure skeptical point of view, it's like, yeah, this is all BS.
Right.
In cold reading. He's just doing cold reading the whole time, and they're editing
the whole
it around.
Time, right.
But, you know, it's still the end. You have these actors who are like, I was a skeptic, but he knew that I had a grandpa.
Right, exactly. And I think it's because some people just think of themselves as being intuitive, right? And they think of it as all intuition. And because they think that they themselves are intuitive and they are able to sort of predict in a way small events or maybe know what somebody's thinking occasionally, right? that they then think that, oh, well, maybe somebody who's actually trained in this could actually do it really, you know, on a more deep level or something like that. So I think it comes from a sense of, you know, I can do this. Mm-hmm. So somebody else probably can too.
Yeah.
And when we magicians realize like, no, as much as I concentrate, you know, nothing happens.
I remember being a little kid looking at a pencil going, I'm going to make that move.
Yeah.
And it never moved.
It never moved.
Until I found invisible thread. And then it moved.
And then it moved. Right.
It
exactly.
Amazing. Or I just breathed on it.
Right.
It's great.
Right.
This is we could go. I could go on for days and piss off so many people about psychic. I mean, I never cared much about it until I saw, I think, my first Penn and Teller show. Or maybe it might have even been like a bullshit episode.
Okay.
But you know, it really is. You know, I love that story. I think I've brought it up many times, but I love that story about how when they were pitching Penn and Teller bullshit. Do you know this?
No, no.
They went into, I think it was, they went into all the meetings, and one of their things was, we know that somebody is going to, we don't know how or who, but somebody is going to use 9/11, you know, use psychic, quote unquote, psychic powers, use 9/11, use the victims of 9/11.
Oh.
And sure enough, like a month or two after, Penn and Teller were in a pitch meeting for Showtime. I forget who it was, but he announced he was going to have a reading for all the relatives of people who lost somebody in the Trade Center. And that was when they're like, okay, yeah, we're gonna green light this show.
Yeah.
Because you're capitalizing on people's tragedies, and you're playing with their emotions, and you think you're helping them, but you're not.
And that was – I mean, I remember looking back into just the sort of recent phenomenon of psychics in the turn of the century here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And actually in the rest of the Western world, where it was really because so many people were dying in the first – in the first war, and because of the various diseases, that so many people's lives were affected by tragedy, you know, in such a short time span.
Oh, sure.
And so drastically, so many lives were everybody's, you know, had somebody who shouldn't have died in the traditional sense, just suddenly died. And so you had this really kind of global sadness that allowed the space for mediums and seances and so forth to just grow incredibly. So I think that it will always be there as long as there is sadness, which, you know, it will always be there. You will always have people who want to communicate with those people. And
my favorite,
understandably so.
My favorite seance story is with Houdini. Do you know this one?
Which one is it? Let's see.
When his mom died.
Yeah.
And so he... You know, he had always had a fascination with death. So he went and talked to a medium, and the medium said, "Your mom says, Harry, you're going to be great. You're going to be fine. I love you." And he left, and he goes, "Well, that was a bunch of bullshit." And whoever he is with goes, "Why? You know what? You knew. You knew all these things." And he's like, "My mom never called me Harry."
Uh-huh.
His name was Eric.
Yeah.
And she spoke Polish, I think.
Oh, or okay. Yiddish or something? Or
Hungarian or something like that.
Yeah.
And I don't know. That's just one of my all-time favorite. Just such a, like a he wanted to believe. He tried,
and there you
just
go.
Such a slap in the face.
Yeah, but he did have the desire to know. He wanted it to exist. You know?
And I think that's the fundamental
thing
about all of it. People want that, and I would love to talk to dead people.
yeah. But it is. He did not let his desire for it to exist to get in the way of his skepticism.
Rational.
Yeah, and I know that whole episode tore apart his relationship with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Oh, interesting.
Because Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was a total believer. He believed in everything, even like, you know, fairies and things like that.
Wow.
And Sir Arthur Conan Doyle ended up, at least the story that I heard, tricking Houdini. He so badly wanted Houdini to believe that he hired somebody, a con woman, to do a reading of him, and they did a reading, and I think what it was she put an X on the page, or a cross on the page. She was sort of like doing I forget what that's called, like an automatic writing type of thing.
Oh, sure.
And and he knew immediately that this is BS because his family's Jewish and she never would have drawn a cross, you know. And there's a whole host of little inaccuracies that tipped him off, but it broke apart the relationship because he knew that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle had hired this person to do this, and that was sort of the end of things.
Interesting.
And there you had Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who, right, you know, I mean, these Sherlock Holmes and the rationalism involved there, and then just totally bought into all sorts of
that
BS.
That is so backwards.
And then you have Houdini, who's like, okay, show me who this guy, this woman is, or guy, whoever it is, and say, okay, yep, I know how that's done. Here's how it is. He'd lay it out, the entire explanation, and Conan Doyle would be like, no, I believe it, you know. So
weird. And it's that's absurd to me because that, you know, Sherlock Holmes is such, like you said, such a rational character and somebody who looks at all the pieces of the puzzle and goes, it was this, 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 put it together.
Right.
and A Man Who Believes in Fairies. That's wild.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I saw pictures of some of the things that he took as proof of fairies, and it was embarrassing. Mm-hmm. You know, really, really bad. Really bad.
Well, getting back to you, we kind of veed off a little bit, but that was fascinating. Anybody who shares my affinity for psychic hatred.
Sure.
Hatred is not right, but just absurdity in a viewing. I see certain elements of religion the same way, and I won't go into too many details. But we always ask a best gig story and worst gig story. Do any come to mind? We've had some pretty good worst gig stories.
Worst gig stories. Let's see here. I did a show once. It wasn't that bad. It was probably 3 or 4 years ago. I was at a private residence. It was a close up show. And and this was back when I was doing the Cups and Balls, which no longer perform really. But the entire room was mirrored, and I did not know about that. And that was kind of funny because I had to adjust quite a bit. It wasn't terrible though. I had a couple shows at the Castle actually that were pretty bad, because when you work at the Castle, whatever your you know, gig is there, you do a lot of shows. And one of the shows, in the close-up gallery, which holds, 25, 30 people, something like that, the first two rows were Japanese. and they were tourists, and they didn't speak any English. And my show is pretty interactive, a lot of talking. And they were very appreciative, but it was a really quiet show. And that's just something, you know, you can't really control at all. And actually, small digression, but I know one of the things that's so great about Michael Amar's show is that he has choreographed so many wonderful moments of instruction that he can perform his show, which he has a full talking show, but he can perform it anywhere, and anybody can know exactly what's happening at any time in the show, which is another wonderful thing to reach for. You know, I definitely don't have that in my show, but that's a nice attribute. Best show. I actually did a show just a couple weeks ago that was really great. It was in Hollywood. It was what initially was supposed to be a couple hours of strolling magic turned into just like 30 people watching me for 2 hours, and they were just having a great time, and everything I was doing was just fantastic. And it was sort of like doing a trade show, because everybody was standing, which is pretty rare for a close-up show, and just huddled around the table. And it was just a show where everybody wanted to be there, you know, because I mean, I know you do corporate work all the time. When you do corporate works, oftentimes, you know, they're employees, they have to be there,
such a toss-up, whether or not they care.
who knows what mm-hmm. what, you know, information was just shared with the employees that day. You know, our sales just dropped 12%. Thanks, guys. You guys got to really pick it up. Okay, Magic Man, come on up. You really don't know. And you have people who just, they have to be there because it's their boss's birthday or whatever it is. So this was a show where everybody wanted to be there, and they were really interested in the magic, and it was fantastic. So and that's really all you can ask for is...
Yeah, it's amazing how, especially in corporate events, how just an audience that just want, even if they care by 20%, makes a whirlwind of difference.
World of a difference.
Instead of people that are like, yeah, what do you want? You know, I just want to sit here and drink.
And especially when you have such an interactive show, if they don't want to be there, it's not a whole lot you can do, you know?
Yeah.
Which is one of the perks of performing at the Castle. Basically, everybody who's there wants to see magic.
It's in the title.
It's in the title, exactly. It's a rare opportunity, but you know, and I still have strolling gigs where I approach somebody and it's like, you know, we really don't want to see magic, which is fine. Obviously, you know, you're not the main attraction, but it does make the event a little less fun.
My favorite thing is when I'll go up to a table and they'll say, no, thank you. And then I'll go do another table and they'll see that they're having a good time and then they'll beckon me over.
That's a nice moment. Yeah.
But there's a part of me that wants to go, nah.
No, you said no the first time.
You had your chance.
That's it. You know? Yeah, that'd be a nice luxury that we don't quite have.
Depends on what kind of mood I'm in. I mean, I'll always try to go back, but there are those times where you're like, you're not paying me.
Right. Or, I mean, it is nice as well to have somebody in that same vein who it's like, okay, I used to do magic, so, you know, let's see what you got. And then they just
I hate those so much.
Oh, yeah?
I hate
them. I enjoy them because generally, you know, they – yeah, okay, they used to do magic, whatever that means. That means, you know, they probably know the 21 card trick or something like that. And by the end, they're like, okay, yeah, this guy – yeah, he knows what he's doing or something.
I felt like there was a period of, 2 months where every other – corporate event I did, some guy would be like, oh, yes, you do magic. Can I show you a card trick? I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever. And it's that card trick where they have to make three piles
right,
of cards.
Right, yeah, the 21 card trick.
That
yeah,
one?
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm like, all right, well, this is good. I get a 15-minute break.
Right, sure. Yeah.
And then it's always awesome when they screw it up because 50-50, they're like, I don't know what happened.
Yeah, right.
You're like, okay,
gotta well, it's same with that. In that same vein, you have the, you know, you take out the cards and they say, oh, yep, uh-huh, I've seen this trick. And it's like, well, there's 500,000, so.
Which
one did you see, you know? The one that starts with me picking a card. You know?
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That would have a lot of kids at Disney would do that. And he's like, oh, I've seen this trick before.
Yeah.
And I would say, oh, there's over thousands of card tricks, and you know exactly which one I'm going to do right now.
Right.
Here's the deck. Go ahead, do it.
Right.
And, you know, depending on how wealthy of a family it was,
sure.
It would either work out or not work out.
Sure.
But anything else you wanted to throw in, anything you wanted to plug? Any parting advice for younger hobbyists or professionals or anything you've experienced that you didn't say?
Well, I would just say perform as much as possible, you know, even when you don't want to. And that's something that I should probably heed more often. But performing as much as possible is just huge because – you know, there's just nothing like performing for real people. As much as you practice in front of the mirror, it's just a totally different ball game, you know. I would also say really try to diversify. One of the best things that I did completely unintentionally, but learn a real diverse range of sleight of hand magic. And, you know, I don't do the sponge balls anymore, let's say, but it's the first thing I learned. And you know, I basically any sleight of hand that I need to pick up, I'll pick it up, right? Whereas I've seen other people who all they ever do is card magic, and it's a real transition for them trying to do something else. So I think that it's really good early on to learn the cups and balls. You know, it's the most important close-up effect, and you know, learn the sponge balls and learn some of those things that even if sure you're not going to really do them later on.
Yeah.
You learn an incredible amount about misdirection and palming and all sorts of things.
Just foundations.
Foundations.
You know, that's something I had to come back to. I always kind of, oh, I don't need to do that. I don't need that. And then you realize when you're trying to do something else, like, oh, I don't have the basic skills for this thing. I have to go back and learn this or
learn
the history of this.
Totally. Yeah. And especially with something like the cups and balls, I think it's just it's so crucial. And
to me, it's so overdone.
It is.
But every time I see it done, especially at the castle, I've only been here 6 months. And I feel like I've seen it every single time I go to the castle.
Yeah.
But you know, people love it, and you know, it's memorable, and it's something they're never going to forget.
Totally.
You know, down at the Hat and Hair, Mike's Chop Cup version is brilliant.
Fantastic.
You know, it's
fantastic.
And every time I go just to watch the people's reactions.
Yeah.
Just to
and they
see
love it.
What he gets away with each time.
And there is something to be said for being unique and not doing something that everybody else is doing. But also, you have, from a commercial standpoint, sometimes people want to see certain tricks, you know? It's I want to see somebody levitate. You know, the last magician I saw did that, and I'm hiring you. I want to see that too, you know? And so, I mean, you want to be unique, but you also have to please people. And
so in the corporate market, you have to please people.
Yeah.
You know, I've learned that quite a bit. Is you can be you can have your unique self, but also you have to placate what they want because they're paying the big bucks.
And also, I don't know why I'm fixating on the cups and balls, but another lesson from it, I think, on the flip side, is that you know, there's a lot of very immature creativity going on in magic where they think like, okay, let's see here. I'm going to do the cups and balls, but instead of little crocheted balls, I'm going to use Tootsie Rolls. And then at the end, I'm going to produce, like, big Tootsie Rolls. And now I just, you know, I was innovative and creative, and my magic set is now, you know, a candy-themed show. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, you have a theme, congratulations, but that's really not innovation, you know? Or, I mean, that's one where I saw specifically. They just did an entire show that was themed with candy, where there wasn't actually any innovation going on. They just replaced everything with candy.
I think people confuse innovation with just an excuse, exactly what you're saying. You have to give them, if you're going to create something, you have to give them something they're going to take home with them, whether that's a feeling or a thought.
Yeah.
And I think a piece of candy isn't going to do that.
Right. And also, I think that when trying to really create a show, right? I mean, there's something, obviously we like to have bookends in a show. We like it to flow and be related. You don't want to just be like, here's another trick, here's another trick, here's another trick. It'd be wonderful if there's some repeating kind of gags that are bringing people together and so forth. But none of those things, but the theme is not a show, you know? And when you're kind of coming up with a show, the people that I admire most, they have a real character. You know, they have a person that they are, and that drives the show.
Yeah,
that drives the material that they choose, that drives the comedy that they use, that drives the surprises. Everything is driven by who they are, their persona. And so I think that, you know, if there's any young magicians listening, like, that is something that you should try to do. Try to figure out who you are as a performer and let that guide your humor. And I see that with myself when I try to write jokes or something like that. It's never as successful as when I'm sort of being in character, whether practicing or performing, and seeing what kind of lines come to my character. Mm-hmm. And those are things that's when you're going to be really original. That's when you're, you know, because you're the only, unless you're just copying somebody else's persona, but that's when you're going to actually have some creative moments. And that's when you're going to really have cohesion in a way that's deeper than, oh, look at that, it was all candy, you know?
If I can
give some advice.
That's great advice. Yeah, that's kind of the whole essence of this stupid podcast.
Okay.
Just like trick, character first, trick comes second.
Yeah.
You know, character will drive the trick. Character will drive the trick.
Exactly. And I think you see that with Penn and Teller, right? Where it's like, they could do any trick. It doesn't really matter. But what drives what they are doing is the character that they're doing, you know? Mm-hmm. Same thing with Darren Brown, somebody I admire greatly.
Yep.
You know, you see his character in every single thing that he's doing, and so much of what he does, even if it's just a book test or a drawing duplication, really couldn't be done by somebody else because
it's a Jerry Seinfeld thing. I mean, I always bring this up. It's just like, only Jerry Seinfeld can do is Jerry Seinfeld jokes, because if anyone else tried, you'd be like, this is a dumb joke.
Right. And you see a lot of times in magic that's not the case.
Sure.
Anybody could have done that.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Cool. Well, thanks for talking with us. Good to speak with you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to Two Magicians, One Mic podcasts. Please rate us on iTunes. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Visit our website, www.twomagiciansonemic.com. Send fan mail or hate mail to twomagiciansonemic@gmail.com. Have a great week.